Welcome to our viewers in the United States and around the world. I'm Christiane Amanpour, and this week we come to you from Jerusalem, New York, and Washington. At the top of the news, make or break Middle East peace talks. First, my exclusive interview with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Do you believe you've convinced some of the skeptics?
I asked them, what's the alternative?
And her message to Iran.
We stand ready to engage with Iran.
So what's his response, the President of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, on his country's nuclear program, human rights?
I'd like your opinion on Sterling.
And the fate of the two American hikers still detained in Iran.
Would you intervene like you did for Sarah?
Ahmadinejad and Clinton, a This Week exclusive. And then...
You betcha!
The Tea Party's Delaware upset.
They call us wacky. They call us wingnuts.
Delaware Republican Party Chairman Tom Ross joins George Will, Peter Beinart of the Daily Beast, and David Sanger of the New York Times to analyze what the Tea Party means for the Republican Party and their chances at the midterms in November. All of this on our roundtable. And the Sunday Funnies.
The Democrats are already attacking O'Donnell. They're calling her the Sarah Palin of the East. And I'm like, really? She's a loud, emotionally unstable woman from Delaware? That's not Sarah Palin, that's Joe Biden.
From all across our world to the heart of our nation's capital, ABC This Week with Christiane Amanpour starts now.
Standing here outside the walls to Jerusalem's Old City, we witnessed some intense negotiations between Israeli and Palestinian leaders who have got down to the core issues, for instance, security and settlements, issues that have eluded their predecessors for more than 60 years. But looming over these talks is a deadline at the end of this month, Israel's self-imposed moratorium on building settlements. Now, publicly, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that Israel cannot extend the moratorium. President Abbas of the Palestinians say that if he's forced to make any more concessions, he will simply walk. But will that be their final positions? After a meeting between Abbas, Netanyahu, and Clinton, I asked whether they had made any progress towards breaking the impasse. Prime Minister Netanyahu told me, "We're working on it. It is a lot of work," he said. And the stakes couldn't be higher for the region, for the Obama administration, and for Secretary Clinton, who says she's still optimistic despite a heavy dose of skepticism all round here. I sat with her after a hectic week of negotiating.
Madam Secretary, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for being here in Jerusalem.
How are the talks going? Are you down beyond the sort of photo op stage? Are you into core issues?
We really are, Christiane, and I have to say it's been impressive to see the two leaders engage so seriously, so early, on what are the core issues. But these talks are already into very sensitive and important areas.
President Obama has said that given the talks going in a constructive way, Israel should continue the moratorium on settlements. Do you believe that that will happen?
Well, that certainly is our hope. Now, we've also said that we'll support an agreement that is reached between the parties. It took a lot of political capital for Prime Minister Netanyahu to achieve this moratorium. It had never been done before, and I rightly, I think, gave him credit for it about a year ago here in Jerusalem. At the same time, it's been in effect for the time that it was set for, and the talks are just starting. So we are working hard to make sure there remains a conducive atmosphere to constructive talks.
Is there any flexibility you can see, any creative diplomacy, as everybody's talking about, to get through this hurdle?
They need to keep talking. And each party, both Israelis and Palestinians, need to figure out a way to make that happen. And I think this president has said, we are committed, we will stay with you, we will do everything we can to facilitate that. At the end of the day, this has to be an agreement between Israelis and Palestinians.
Who do you think is making the biggest psychological leap, the biggest leap of heart?
I think both are. You know, Israel today is under tremendous security pressure, and they can look over the horizon and see even more when you've got a country like Iran standing by saying, we want to wipe you from the face of the earth and annihilate you. I mean, that does concentrate your mind. And on the Palestinian side, we've been down this road you know, we're trying to build our own institutions of a new state. You know, can we really afford to not do it?
Is it the U.S. position to press President Abbas to stay even if the moratorium is lifted?
We don't want either party to leave these negotiations or to do anything that causes the other to leave the negotiations.
Are you urging President Abbas to stay?
We are having very, you know, very clear conversations with each. And I will certainly urge him to continue in the negotiations, just as I've urged Prime Minister Netanyahu and as President Obama has said, to continue the moratorium.
Do you believe you've convinced some of the skeptics, for instance, the Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who you also spoke to? Have you convinced him that this two-state solution, this process, is the right one?
I don't claim to convince someone whose views are very different from that position. I think that he and many Israelis are quite skeptical, just as many Palestinians are quite skeptical. But I ask them, what's the alternative? I mean, what is the alternative?
Can we move on to Iran? Can I first ask you, what is your reaction to the release of Sarah Shord?
Great relief. I was so pleased that this young woman was able to come home. I want the other two young Americans, Josh and Shane, to come home as well. But as a mother, I've met with their mothers, and I just can't even imagine how painful the experience that they themselves have had inside prison, but then, of course, the pain that their families feel. So thankfully, she'll be given a chance to be reunited now.
Will there be any further talks at any time soon on the nuclear issue? Is there any date, any agreement from the Iranians to meet in a P5 plus one?
Well, we thought that they were open to that, and we certainly had indicated our readiness to meet. Now, at the United Nations next week, I will be meeting with my counterparts of the P5 plus one to discuss where matters stand. But as we're speaking right now, I know of no meeting that the Iranians have agreed to attend.
On the one hand, you say that you're grateful that Iran released Sarah Shord as a humanitarian gesture. You need to do diplomacy through the P5 plus one on the nuclear issue. On the other hand, in your speech and in your comments at the Council on Foreign Relations, you said that it's a country morphing into a military dictatorship. Explain that.
Well, Christiane, I'm concerned about what I see going on. And I am, of course, grateful and appreciative that Sarah was released and want to see not only her two compatriots, but other Americans who are held without cause released as well. And we are concerned about the nuclear program. But what we also see happening is increasing power exercised by the military, by the Revolutionary Guard and by other militia and military entities. And I know that that's a concern of people inside Iran, as we read reports coming out of Iran. And it is something that would be even more distressing for the Iranian people. You know, I have grave disagreements with the Iranian Revolution, but the early advocates of it said this would be a republic. It would be an Islamic republic, but it would be a republic. Then we saw a very flawed election, and we've seen the elected officials turn to the military to enforce their power. And a lot of Iranians, even those who stayed, even those who were originally sympathetic, are starting to say, this is not what we signed up for. And I can only hope that there will be some effort inside Iran by responsible civil and religious leaders to, you know, take hold of the apparatus of the state.
Let me ask you what the United States can do, as you say, to support the people of Iran. You know, during the Cold War, as you know so well, the Helsinki Accords,
yes,
were the framework,
yes,
by which the United States pressed the Soviet Union on human rights while still negotiating on arms control.
Right.
Why is it the United States today does not have a framework or any sustained intention of pressing Iran on human rights while still trying to figure out the nuclear situation? We keep hearing that officials don't want to upset the diplomatic apple cart.
No, I don't think that's it at all. I mean, we have spoken out on human rights. We have done the best we could to support those inside through trying to open up access to telecommunications. So we are very much in favor of and speaking out on behalf of individual cases and more generally the human, political, civil rights of Iranians. And remember, when President Obama came into office, he extended his hand, I mean, very clearly and quite unprecedentedly to the Iranian leadership and said, we would be willing to have a diplomatic engagement with you. I think the sanctions that have been endorsed and now are being implemented by the international community, you know, demonstrates our engagement because we've said to the Iranians all along, we have two tracks. We have the pressure track and we have the engagement diplomatic track. And we still remain open to that diplomacy. But it's been very clear that the Iranians don't want to engage with us. And the final point I would make is, you know, we are trying to be effective as we help those inside Iran. We get, and I meet with Iranian experts, and we get different advice. We get some who say, you know, full speed ahead, don't worry about it, just say whatever you have to say. Others who say, don't do that, this is a very delicate balance. So we try to walk that line.
Does it concern you that so many Iranians after the election, so many of the protesters really weren't sure whether the Obama administration was on their side and to this day remain unsure, Iranians inside Iran?
Well, I don't know how that could be because we made it very clear that we supported the legitimate efforts of the Iranian people to protest and demonstrate against a flawed election. We made it very clear to the Iranians that we thought that they had not only conducted an illegitimate election, but counter to their own stated and professed laws and constitution. So we made it very clear, but we also knew that the worst thing for those protesting was for them to be seen as stooges of the United States. So again, what we've tried to do is to stand up for the human rights of every person, most particularly those brave Iranians, you know, lawyers and activists and others who are standing up and saying to the regime, no, you have to fulfill the promises you yourselves have made about what we should expect without undermining their efforts. Now, it's very delicate, and we some days we get it right, and some days maybe we could do better. But our bottom line is, you know, we think the Iranian people deserve so much more than what they are now being given, and we are worried about the direction we see Iran headed.
The sanctions. President Ahmadinejad has said the sanctions are, quote, pathetic, worse than a used handkerchief. Do you think they have any possibility of actually affecting their nuclear behavior?
Well, first, I think they have and will continue to affect their behavior. In fact, you know, former President Rafsanjani said just the other day, these are serious. They need to be taken seriously. He was, in effect, criticizing his government because of comments like that, that yes, they're biting, and we hear that from many in the region and beyond. And in fact, the information we're getting is that the Iranian regime is quite worried about the impact on their banking system, on their economic growth, because they've already encountered some tough economic times, and this is, you know, making it more costly. Sanctions are a tool. They're not an end in themselves. And, you know, we would very much like to see Iran return to the P5 plus one forum where they were last present a year ago, October, to talk about their nuclear program. We would like to see them once again permit full IAEA inspections. We would like to see them taking the offer that has been made by us and others to talk about a broad range of issues like their support for terrorism, Hamas, Hezbollah, et cetera. So we stand ready to engage with Iran. And that's really the message that I would like to send to the Iranians is that, you know, there's a way out of the sanctions. There's a way out of increasing opprobrium from the international community. And there should be a way out of this takeover of their political system and a threat to their dual system of elected and clerical leadership, because when you empower a military as much as they have to rely on them to put down legitimate protests and demonstrations, you create a momentum and unleash forces that you do not know where they will end up. And so we think that, that now is the time for the Iranian leadership to engage seriously.
Secretary Clinton, thank you very much for joining us.
As Clinton says, Iran looms large over this process and over security for the entire region. Next, we go to New York, where leaders from all over the world are coming for the UN General Assembly. And I sit down with Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who has turned these annual UN appearances into a regular attempt to seek out the media and press his case. Mr. President, thank you for joining us. The United States is very pleased that you have released Sarah Shord, and the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has said that she wants the other two, Josh and Shane, to be released also, a humanitarian gesture.
It's true that the Islamic Republic of Iran took a humanitarian measure and released one of the three individuals who entered our borders, Ms. Sarah Shord. This was a huge humanitarian gesture. Now, you may be aware that eight Iranians are illegally being detained in the United States. So I believe that it would not be misplaced to ask that the U.S. government should make a humanitarian gesture to release the Iranians who were illegally arrested and detained here in the United States.
Mr. President, I understand that the Iranians, many of them, have been convicted of various sanctions busting and arms busting. So are you saying you're holding the two Americans as hostages for the release of Iranians here?
No. But how would you know that those Iranians are criminals? Are you a judge?
May I show you something? I just want to show you a recording.
We thank you for bringing Sarah home, but now it is time for bringing Josh and Shane home. And we urge you, again, with your humanitarianism of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to show the same compassion you had for Sarah to bring Josh and Shane home.
Last May, when you were here, you talked about being a friend to the American people. Shane and Josh are American people. Their families are American people. Please release both of them back to their families.
We are saddened that there are individuals in prison, and it makes us unhappy when people are in prison anywhere in the world, whether in Iran or in the United States or elsewhere. We want people to be free and not to suffer. But in the end of the day, there's a law that determines who stays in prison and who does not.
And do you think they'll be released anytime soon? Would you intervene like you did for Sarah?
I would give a recommendation, but the cases have to be examined. They violated the law.
Let's move on to the nuclear issue. The United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told me that they would like to have a discussion with Iran in the P5+1 over the nuclear issue. Before Ramadan, Iran said it was looking to have another meeting, but there's been no further word on it. Are you going to have a meeting with the United States in the P5+1 on the nuclear issue?
On this trip?
Anytime soon.
Yes, we have a plan to discuss things, to discuss issues. We've always been ready to discuss issues as long as they're within the legal framework and based on principles of justice and respect. Now, having said that, all our nuclear activities are being controlled by cameras. Material that is moved is weighed, is examined, and controlled. So as far as the IAEA supervision is concerned, there's no blockage of that supervision. Now, some of these individuals have released our nuclear information, the information that we have provided, which is illegal. The IAEA is required by a statute to protect that information, not to release it. And plus, the IAEA is aware of several other violations that they have committed. Now, we believe that here, the United States is pressing the IAEA to take a political position on the issue. Once the IAEA does that, its work becomes worthless and ineffective.
Sanctions. The United Nations, the United States, the European Union, Japan, South Korea, Russia, China, everybody's put sanctions on Iran. Are you surprised that they were so uniform?
It is meaningless to us.
Well, it's interesting you to say this. Former president of Iran, Rafsanjani, has given a speech in which he urged you not to take the sanctions as a joke, to take them seriously, and he says that they're the most tough sanctions that Iran has ever experienced. Do you consider them a joke, or do you take them seriously?
In Iran, people are free to make statements, to say what they think. There are no restrictions on what people say.
No, but the question is, do you take the sanctions seriously, or do you consider them a joke, ineffective, not serious?
We do take sanctions seriously, but taking it seriously is different from believing that they are effective. These are two different issues. We consider this as and have recorded it as a serious violation of international law. It was illegal, it was wrong, they wronged the people of Iran by insulting them, and these sanctions will definitively mark a new level of progress in our economy. We have turned sanctions around and created opportunities out of it. Now, this does mean certainly that we take it seriously, but it does not mean that it has a negative influence on our economy, because it does not.
But this time, in fact, people are saying that it is having a negative influence. Businessmen will not be able to do enough trade. Shipping is going to be difficult. Insuring ships is going to be difficult.
None of this is a problem. I want to stress it is not a problem. If you want to say it's effective, why not wait for the next 6 months or a year to see with your own eyes whether there are effects or not? And I tell you, there are none.
I want to ask you about human rights. You know the lady Sakineh Mohammad Ashtiani, who was sentenced to stoning. Her sentence was lifted. What do you personally think of stoning? Do you think that's an appropriate sentence for anybody in today's modern Iran?
Why do you think that the issue of one lady in a village in Iran called Ms. Mohammadi should suddenly become such a big issue for American officials?
I'm surprised that you don't think that it's likely to be a big issue. And it's not just American officials, it's all over the world. It was international.
Allow me.
I want to know what your view is on stoning. Do you think it's appropriate and fitting for a modern country and a nuclear want to be nuclear power?
Why don't you finish your statements and then allow me to speak?
I'm asking your opinion.
Well, if you want me to if you want to lecture me, you can, but that's fine.
I'm asking your opinion.
I wouldn't be offended. I have a lot of patience.
Okay. I'd like your opinion on stoning.
First, what I want to say is that Ms. Mohammadi was never sentenced to stoning. This was news that was produced and incorrect, and regrettably, U.S. media was infected by U.S. politicians to make a piece of news out of this.
But the Iranian government lifted the sentence.
Allow me. When? I represent the Iranian government. How come is it that I am unaware of what you are telling me and that you should be aware of it? This is an issue that is being considered. It's still being processed. Given that there was no sentence of stoning issued in the first place, this was a news that was made up. The propaganda behind it was big. And then those same murderers of people become supporters of human rights. Now, this is an ancient method that needs to change. It's natural. Anybody can have an opportunity over an issue and propagate about it. But we are opposed to the way the United States manages the world, manages Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere.
Now, since we're talking about this, since you've been president, executions in Iran have increased by four times Did you know that?
That is not true at all. Not at all. Not at all.
You deny that? Independent
no.
human rights groups say that?
How do they know? They haven't come to Iran.
Can I move on to ask you about the leaders of the opposition, Mr. Mousavi and Mr. Karoubi? Their offices have been raided recently. Mr. Mousavi's computers have been taken. And the prosecutor general in Tehran is saying that a trial and a case is being built against them and that they will go to trial if and once public opinion is readied. Is that something that you approve of and you agree with? Do you know that a case is being prepared against Mr. Mousavi and or Mr. Karoubi?
You see, if they wanted to build a case, they should have done it last year.
So you don't think it's happening?
I don't think it's even necessary. They were free. They're still free. They're going on with their daily lives.
Why does he say that then? That a trial will take place?
Who said
Mr. Jafari Dolatabadi. A trial will take place when it'll be in the interest of the ruling establishment and once public opinion is ready. Do you accept that? Do you agree with it and approve it?
I do not get involved in the business of the judiciary. The judge is independent, but I think that when you translate these statements, you've probably made or interpreted it, you've made a mistake in analyzing it. I am unaware of the details of what people do. The judiciary is aware of those details, but I can tell you, I mean, you gave me a piece of news, and I'm telling you that if a case was to be built, it should have been done last year.
What did you think when Fidel Castro said, Mr. President, stop attacking the Jews, stop denying the Holocaust, stop being anti-Semitic? Fidel Castro, Cuba is a friend of Iran.
Well, shouldn't he be free to say what he wants? He's free to say what he wants. We have never been anti-Semitic. When was I anti-Semitic? The Jews live in Iran, like every other person who lives in Iran freely.
You know, Hillary Clinton told me, and she's told others, that the United States is very concerned about the increasing militarization of the Iranian government, that the Revolutionary Guard is very involved, not just in its military activities, but in politics, in economics, in business, that they're cracking down on the people. As you know, there are still hundreds of election protesters in jail, many of them without evidence, without trial. Why the militarization of the Iranian system? Why?
Don't you think that Ms. Clinton should think a little bit before she makes statements of such nature? I think Ms. Clinton is a very respected woman, but she should really gather more correct information to base her statements on accurate information.
I have to ask you this one last question. I just want to know if there's any chance that you will respond to the invitation of the Obama administration to engage with the United States.
I invited him to engage.
Well,
to
he sent a letter and he talked about it publicly.
I was the one who started the invitation. I was the first to send a letter of invitation, and he never responded to the letter. I announced in the United Nations that we are ready to talk in the United Nations in the presence of others. I didn't receive an answer. Iran was the country that released Sarah. We haven't even received a note from the United States on that. We were always prepared to talk, but under fair conditions and respectful conditions. If somebody thinks that they can, like, order us around or rule us, and call it a talk, that wouldn't work. But if they are ready to sit down, respect the law, be fair and just, we're always prepared to talk.
Mr. President, thank you very much.
This is not a race we're going to be able to win. I mean, there are just a lot of nutty things she's been saying.
I've never heard Carl so animated against a Democrat as he was against Christine O'Donnell.
He's the same so-called political guru that predicted I wasn't going
to
win.
These folks are going to shake it up, and they are going to do what's right for America, okay. Not necessarily
let me stop.
A political party machine.
She's right on the issues, but do you have the character and record and background that gives me confidence you're the right person for the job?
Back in Washington now, and some reaction from Republicans to Christine O'Donnell's upset win in the Delaware primary. We'll talk about that on our roundtable, but first we get a little reaction to what we've just heard from Ahmadinejad and Secretary Clinton, with George Will, with Peter Beinart, senior writer at the Daily Beast and professor at the City University of New York, Tom Ross, the Delaware Republican Party chairman, and David Sanger of the New York Times. Thank you all for being here today. What do you think Hillary Clinton said about relations and about the possibility of a peace agreement?
Well, she said everyone's very serious in engaging the issues, which is, takes you to square one.
And the moratorium, do you think that'll stay?
I think they'll fudge that. That is, they'll say we're going to continue building in the enormous blocks contiguous to Jerusalem that no one expects to be transferred as part of any final settlement. With regard to the 100,000 or so settlers that are not contiguous to Jerusalem, that remains to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Remember, the biggest military operation Israel has had since between the Yom Kippur War and the war in southern Lebanon in 2006 was against Israelis. It was more than about 40,000 or some Israeli defense forces used to extract Israelis from Gaza.
And they're definitely hoping that they don't have to face any of that in the West Bank. And we were told one of the things that they so don't want to see is any forced removal of any settlers in any kind of peace agreement. What did you get from Ahmadinejad?
Well, a few things, I thought. First, his statement that all nuclear activity is being monitored by cameras sort of missed the big part of what's going on with the nuclear inspections, or more importantly, what isn't going on. It's been 2 years now, the International Atomic Energy Agency says, since they first asked for most of the documents that they suspect would answer the question of whether there's a military dimension to the nuclear program, whether or not people have been working on warhead designs and missile designs that could be merged with nuclear material. All of those questions have gone completely unanswered. And so I think what you heard President Ahmadinejad do was try to narrow this question to cameras sitting in some places where very few people believe the more suspicious nuclear work is underway. The inspectors haven't been allowed to interview almost any of the leading scientists in this area.
And yet, you know, it's really difficult, I think, to get a real grip on this, because when you talk to U.S. officials, they say, well, the main nuclear facilities, we can see that there's no diversion of material.
That's right.
They are continuing to inspect there, and still, what I find very frustrating is whether it's the United States or Israel, whether it's Russia or others, they all have a vast disparity on when they think there will be either breakout capability or some kind of weaponization. So I think that is what frustrates this whole conversation so incredibly much. Let us get down to the politics, because the Tea Party surprise, is it a surprise, George? Was Christine O'Donnell a real surprise?
Well, it's a surprise in a year full of surprises, so we shouldn't be quite so surprised.
So what was the message?
Well, the message
by
was,
the Republicans.
The message was, turn them out. It was stir it up. It is the fact that you lack Washington experience is a considerable plus these days.
Tom Ross, chairman of the Delaware Republican Party, you are not a happy man today.
I'm not a happy man. We have worked very diligently in a very difficult environment. I'm a Republican chairman in the Northeast. My state is vastly Democratic. Most people identify themselves as a moderate. We have the Vice President of the United States, political machine, residing there. We have a very popular governor in Jack Markell, who also happens to be the chair of the Democratic Governors Association. And we work very diligently as a party with grassroots delegates to select candidates that best fit the seat. We work very diligently to not necessarily articulate the Buckley Rule, but to live by it, to find conservatives that can win. We had a candidate that was very close to becoming the next United States Senator from Delaware, and essentially people on our own team clipped him right as he is about to go on the goal line.
Well, let me put up some of the things you said about Christine O'Donnell's win before the primary. Let me just put this up and see what you're saying about it today.
If she were, by some miracle, to be our nominee, that we would lose this seat and lose it by unprecedented numbers.
So now you've had to circle the wagons.
Well, no one likes to be wrong. Do I wish I'd said that in those terms? I do not.
But you said even worse.
Should we put that up?
You're welcome to.
Let's put that up. You said that she's got about as much chance of being elected to office as being elected dog catcher. I mean, that is pretty out there.
Well, let me tell you, I am not a guru or a talking head or a hired gun. I am a partisan political party leader in a very difficult state to win elections. My job is to stand with our endorsed candidate, and I did that, and I'm proud of what I've done. The voters have spoken, and now my job is, whether I like it or not, or I'm indifferent, is to go out there and work just as hard to get each and every Republican that the voters have selected elected in a very difficult environment.
So is this a fad, as Mayor Bloomberg has said? Is the Tea Party a fad, or is it something much deeper that one shouldn't underestimate?
No, the Tea Party is now the Republican Party. I mean, I think what we're seeing in the Republican Party is something akin to what happened in the Democratic Party between 1968 and 1972, in which the forces of George McGovern it took over the Democratic Party, overthrew the Democratic Party establishment, and moved it substantially to the left. What they didn't realize was while they were able to take over the Democratic Party, they were pushing that party further away from where average Americans are. The Republicans will do great in 2010, but I think Sarah Palin is really the Republicans' George McGovern. And when they go to a general election against Barack Obama in 2012 with a divided party, with lots of people like this gentleman here, in fact, not very happy about the direction of the Republican Party, they will see that this has not been a positive development for
them. But 8 months ago, the worry was, or the worst-case analysis for Republicans was that the Tea Party energies would be diverted into third-party rival candidacies, splitting the conservative vote in this country. Sarah Palin, think of her what you will, has brought them into the Republican Party, and they are one of the main reasons for what is going to be probably decisive in November, and that is the enormous enthusiasm and intensity gap that favors the Republicans this year.
Let's just put up, actually, you talk about that. Let's just put up the poll, which basically says that amongst independents, some 42% are more favorable to the Tea Party, and same 42% are unfavorable. But when it comes to likely voters, that number shoots up, the more favorable one.
That's because core Democratic groups, you have to remember this about a midterm, like African Americans, Hispanics, young voters, don't turn out in midterms significantly. Midterms are not a good predictor of general elections. There's no question that Republicans are going to have a fabulous fall. But the question is, what are people like Christine O'Donnell and the increased ascendancy of Sarah Palin do for their chances in 2012? Remember how Bill Clinton used Newt Gingrich and wrapped him around the neck of Bob Dole when he tried to run? We're going to see that again.
And who actually is Christine O'Donnell? Who is Christine O'Donnell? People say she's new, but in fact, she's not that new. She's been toiling in activism for many, many years.
She has been an activist for a long time, and she has run before as well. And I think perhaps because she fared so poorly in the previous elections was one of the reasons that she was so underestimated this time. But I think the really interesting question about her is, does she now become a symbol that will encourage other candidates to go her route? Or instead, does the rest of the Republican Party try to embrace the anger that was behind her victory without embracing the extremism? And I think, as Peter suggested, that's going to be the very difficult dividing line here, which is how to grab this enthusiasm, which, as George points out, is a huge gap between the two parties right now.
I think what we've got to realize, though, here is essentially this election is going to be a referendum on Obama. And while off-term elections are difficult for the president, he really doesn't have anything to hang his hat on. And if Christine O'Donnell can keep to that message that my opponent is a rubber stamp for the Obama agenda and I will oppose it, there is a path to victory. It won't be an easy one. But my point is not the messenger, or not that we oppose Tea Party type values in terms of getting our debt under control or keeping taxes down. Mine is a conservative message that local activists within the party that are grassroots delegates need to have the opportunity to be able to select their candidate without outside forces coming in and bigfooting them.
You know, you talked about staying on message and keeping the message. You know, she hasn't actually given that many interviews. She hasn't actually, you know, for instance, today she's canceled two scheduled appearances on other Sunday programs. And so bits are coming out in dribs and drabs, including Bill Maher, the political satirist who's had her on perhaps some 22 times, and he's beginning to drib and drab out bits of video. Look at this one.
Gab dabbled into witchcraft. I never joined a coven.
Wait a minute. You were a witch?
Yeah, she was a witch.
You were a witch?
I dabbled into witchcraft. I hung around people who were doing these things.
Having fun?
I'm not making this stuff up. I know what they told me they do. One of my first dates with a witch was on a satanic altar, and I didn't know it. And, I mean, there's a little blood and stuff like that.
That was a date?
Your first date was
a satanic altar?
Yeah,
we went to a movie and then, like, had a little midnight picnic.
Let's have a movie and a sacrifice?
So that was 1999.
Right.
Is it right to hold her accountable for saying things like that?
Well, you know, that was a long time ago. I wish Christine hadn't said that. I'm sure at this point Christine wishes she hadn't said that. I bet you she even more wishes she hadn't been wherever she was. But the bottom line is, as we saw in the last 2 weeks, voters are mad as hell. They're scared, and they do not like the direction of this country's going. And if she stays on message...
Not that message.
Not that message.
No, but what is
if Republicans
mad as
pick
hell?
Up the Wiccan vote, that could be a real add to the valuable vote.
What, anger is not a government strategy. What, in fact, does the Tea Party stand for? What is their manifesto? Is it social values, as she and others have said? Is it debt, big government, repealing health care? What exactly is it?
It is the sense that no one voted for this, that no one voted for government ownership of General Motors, that no one voted for $8.5 trillion worth of debt to be piled up in the next decade. It is fright is what it is. It's less anger, I think, than shock and awe statism that has turned people off. You know, we're missing the story here. 20 months ago, standing up there in the Capitol, we were at the apotheosis of Barack Obama, 40 years of Democratic control coming up. 20 months later, the question is, well, maybe the Democrats can hold one or even both houses of Congress. Let me give you a list here. This week, Charlie Cook, probably the best political handicapper in this town, moved Connecticut Senate race from leans Democratic to toss-up. There are 12 Democratic-held seats right now that are either where the Republican is either way ahead, slightly ahead, tied, or slightly behind. Connecticut, Washington, California, Nevada, Colorado, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Indiana, North Dakota, Arkansas, Wisconsin, and West Virginia. That's a pan of strength.
In some of these states, there are Tea Party candidates. And I thought one of the things the Republican Party was worried about is, you know, losing that advantage and perhaps independents or others going for the Democratic candidate.
Well, quite frankly, the fallacy of a moderate Democrat is out the window. In 2006 and 2008, the Democratic Party had huge pickups where they took candidates in very conservative districts and they stood up and said, you know what, I'm a conservative Democrat. Well, I think the Obama agenda in terms of health care, spending, the proposed taxes that have been thrown around, that fallacy is gone. And people are rallying to reject that and say, you know what, we've got to turn back the tide. This is out of hand. The other point I want to make is a lot's been bantied about the Republican Party of Delaware being, quote unquote, establishment. Nothing could be further from the truth. At the same convention where we nominated and endorsed Mike Castle, we also endorsed perhaps the most conservative member of our delegation in
Dover.
Why
didn't you stand up stronger? People are saying that the established Republicans didn't stand up stronger against the Tea Party candidates and let them sort of roll all over them.
I think I stood up pretty strong. I think
everyone
knows where I stood.
In general.
You know, we're not opposed to Tea Party values. What we're opposed to is people coming in from out of state and dumping hundreds of thousands of dollars on candidates that we have not endorsed and misrepresenting the records of our endorsed candidates.
And if those candidates do get elected in November, what does that mean to governance, to some of the programs that are on the table right now? What does it mean?
You know, President Obama had a fairly successful legislative first 20 months by his own terms. He got health care through, he got the financial regulation through, and he got through many of the stimulus programs that now have become the cores, as George says, of the opposition. I think what he has failed to do so far is explain the deficits, which I think has a lot of people scared, and explain a plan for getting out from that. The jobs issues have moved very slowly, as he has said. And even in those areas where he took temporary action, George mentioned the General Motors sector, they're likely General Motors is going to go public, the U.S. government's probably going to get its money back. I think most Americans probably don't understand that yet, and President Obama has not done a very good job of making that clear.
We're going to have to continue this discussion in the roundtable at the Green Room at abcnews.com/thisweek, where all week you can find our fact checks in conjunction with PolitiFact.
Turnout was lower than expected, but still more than 3.5 million Afghans overcame the threat of violence and fraud to vote in parliamentary elections on Saturday. The Taliban disrupted the vote with attacks on some polling booths and more than 10 people were killed, which makes our picture this week even more remarkable. Afghan citizens brandishing what seems to have become a symbol of democracy this decade, their purple fingers. And that's our program for today. Thank you for watching, and we hope to see you next week.